Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, Chair of the Grownups Forum and your host for today. It's my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here. We know you'll enjoy the membership and look forward to seeing you here often. At this time, please do turn off your cell phones and other devices. Now, here are some of our upcoming events for the Grownups Forum. On Tuesday, July 24th, Attorney John E. O'Grady will discuss age-old estate planning questions raised in classic film clips in his popular educational seminar, Estate Planning in Film. Thursday, August 21st, Mark Friedman, CEO of Civic Ventures, will speak from his new book, The Big Shift, thoughts from his book on navigating the new stage beyond midlife. These are just two of the many upcoming events, and I invite you to pick up a copy of the new Commonwealth magazine in the lobby or check our website for a complete listing of our events. You're right, they took them away. I'll see about that. I'm sure it was a child and made a mistake. You may register for these programs online at commonwealthclub.org or by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. Before we proceed, I proudly introduce you to the group which has collaborated with the Grownups Forum to bring you today's program, and that's San Francisco Village. San Francisco Village is a membership program that allows older adults to have support and services at home, in their community, and among their friends. We are recording today's program, so please make sure now that all cell phones and portable devices are turned off. And now I'll begin today's program. Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, Chair of the Club's Grownups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to listen online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. We're most fortunate to have as our speaker tonight Mary K. McEachern, the Chief Administrative Officer and General Counsel of the Buck Institute. Mary was a founding director of the Institute. She practiced law in San Francisco here at Orrick Sutliff as a partner, and after the Buck Trust trial, left to start the Buck Institute. So she knows this organization from the ground up, and we're fortunate to have her with us tonight. And Mary, can I invite you to come and address us? Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. It's a privilege to be here at the Commonwealth Club's Grownups Forum. And thank you so much for the invitation. The Buck Institute for Research on Aging was founded to extend health span, the healthy, productive years of life, through research and education. That's our mission, and tonight I'm going to be explaining a little bit about how we are approaching that mission, how we're seeking to extend the healthy, productive years of life. Because what we know is that chronologic age is not a necessary correlate to physiologic age. Our CEO, Dr. Brian Kennedy, uses as an example his two grandmothers, one of which lived until 99 but started experiencing health problems at the age of 60. So, in other words, almost over a third of her life was spent with chronic health problems, whereas his other grandmother, who is still alive, she just celebrated her 100th birthday in Louisville, Kentucky, in March. She bowled her last 200 game at the age of 91, and she didn't quit driving until the age of 92. But she still lives alone. So what's the difference here? Of course, you know, obviously, Dr. Kennedy has very good genes in terms of longevity in either case. But what's the difference? Why is there a difference in the health span of different individuals? And more worrisome, why is health span decreasing as a proportion of lifespan? And during the 20-year period from 1981 to 2001, female life expectancy increased 3 years, over 3 years, from 77 in 1981 to 80 in 2001. And male life expectancy experienced an even bigger jump during that same two-decade period. And yet, healthy life expectancy did not show that same trajectory. The healthy life expectancy increased just 2 years for females and about 3 years for females, for males. In other words, as this trend continues, we in America, and in fact throughout the world, are experiencing more and more of our lifespan in poor health. Lifespan continues to increase, health span as well, but not at the same rate. Now, why is that the case? Well, in large part, it is because we have converted so many of our chronic, of our what used to be fatal conditions into now chronic conditions. Heart disease used to be a death sentence. Cancer used to be a death sentence. And now we experience years of living with chronic conditions. This is a problem not only in America. I shouldn't say it's a problem. It's an opportunity, not only in America, but throughout the world, because as America is aging, so is the rest of the world. This is so dramatic that in the year 2002, only countries in Europe and Japan experienced up to a 25% population of 60 and older. By the year 2050, there's going to be an explosion of seniors, 50 and 60 and older. And the majority of the world is going to experience up to 25% of their population, in many cases above 25% of their population, as seniors. This is especially dramatic in Asia. Japan, of course, is leading. And by the year 2050, they will have almost 40% of their population as seniors. Now that, of course, as we all know, is a great opportunity, an opportunity to take advantage of the wisdom of seniors, but it's also a problem. Because as we increase lifespan without keeping health span on the same trajectory, we're not only increasing the personal issues that we experience from the frailty and diseases of aging, but we're also exacerbating the societal problems. When the Buck Institute for Research in Aging was first proposed, it was thought that by the year 2010, the cost of taking care of America's Alzheimer's victims would be $100 billion a year. So back in the 1990s, it was thought $100 billion a year. How will we ever pay for that? Well, we now have the numbers for the care of America's Alzheimer's victims in the year 2010, and it was $170 billion for the care of for one disease, one nation. As the world gets older and older, the economic implications of the aging population are going to be enormous. So what can we do about it, and what are we doing about it at the Buck Institute? Well, first of all, you think this is obvious, that aging is highly correlated to chronic disease. So many conditions, of course, appendicitis, that doesn't increase much with age, but so many of the chronic conditions that we experience are highly, highly correlated to age. One example is cancer. 80% of all cancers occur after the age of 54. Other conditions, of course, you know about neurodegeneration issues, such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. But it's also true of a whole host of chronic and debilitating conditions that increase with age. At the Buck Institute, we believe that's not just a correlation, that aging is, in fact, the cause of these chronic conditions, that it is cell senescence that is causing Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and the age-related cancers, that aging itself must be addressed, that we must come to understand the basic process of aging if we're going to really understand how to cure Alzheimer's or prevent Alzheimer's, I should say, or Parkinson's or stroke. And this is the theory, that it is aging, that the process of cellular aging is, in fact, resulting in neurodegeneration. Dr. Judith Campisi has spent her life demonstrating that it is the process of aging which is causing age-related cancers. But so many other things as well. Stroke, diabetes, arthritis, heart disease, and of course, as all of you know, as I know, wrinkles and eventually frailty. So that causative relationship, you may think that's obvious, right? Okay, if with a correlation that high, there must be a causative effect in place. And while that seems intuitive, in fact, sometimes it seems almost obvious, it's not reflected in federal spending on health care, on health research. Cancer, this is the, in billions, cancer, we spend $5 billion a year of federal funds, NIH, National Institutes of Health funds, on cancer research. Heart, lung, and blood, $3 billion. Diabetes, digestive, kidney problems, $2 billion. Neurological disorders, almost $2 billion. And yet, on the basic biology of aging, on understanding the basic biology of aging, we spend only $1 billion. Now, if aging is in fact the cause of age-related cancers, wouldn't it make more sense to understand aging, to address cancer and neurodegenerative disease as an outgrowth of aging, and to understand the basic biology of aging as a way of understanding how we can address and prevent those? So that is what the Institute is doing. We try to understand the basic biology of aging, and we address age-related diseases as well. And many of our faculty do both simultaneously, and they all collaborate across lines so that the people who are trying to understand the basic biology of aging are working with the cancer researchers. Those trying to understand molecular degeneration at the basic cellular level are also working with people trying to understand brain degeneration. Now, just a little bit of background. Aging research, as most medical research, uses a number of different models. At the Buck Institute, we do not use all of these. But the animal models that are used for aging research are yeast, flies, Drosophila, and worms. Those are the most common. Also, rodents, mice, and rats. And at the Institute, that's all we use. We only use animals at the rodent level and below to address aging. This, you say, well, what can we learn about yeast? Well, yeast age. They divide. They age and they die, as do flies, as do worms. The great thing about those models is that they do it so quickly, over a matter of days, that if you tried to do the same research with higher mammals, the principal investigator would be long dead before there were any significant results. And yet with flies and yeast and worms, you can have generation after generation and see the impact generation after generation. With flies and yeast and worms, they age quickly. It's cost effective. We can do genetic screens. The query is, do we know that is related to human aging? Do we know that these are telling us valid results that address human aging? And we think more and more and more that that is the case, and that these, for many conditions, are just as effective as screens as our rodent models. But rodent models, of course, mammals, it's very important to take any research into a mammal before it's tried in a human being. Okay, so then what do we do after that? Once we know what affects a worm or what affects a yeast in terms of aging, what increases the aging, what accelerates aging, or what slows it down, we can look for the genes that are expressed in those conditions. And where there's an overlap between the genes in the worm, you do that with knockouts. And so where there's an overlap between the genes that are affected by a certain condition in worms and the genes that are affected by that same condition in yeast, where there's an overlap, you then take it into mice. Again, rodents are a very expensive model to use. And we never use a mouse when there's an alternative. If we can use flies or worms, we always do that. So we wait until we have the results in flies and worms. Then we can try it in mice by knocking out that same gene that has found to be impacted by the aging process in worms and yeast. You knock it out in mice, and you see what happens. Sometimes they age more rapidly. Sometimes nothing happens. Sometimes they age more slowly. And that's what we're finding out. So then you're thinking, okay, well, wait a second. What can we learn from basic biology? How are we really going to cure cancer by understanding the basic biology of aging that is so far removed from what you think is important to your health? So I want to prove you wrong. I want to show you that the basic biology of aging is giving us enormous clues about what is causing those chronic conditions that we experience. And the first clue of that, this did not come out of the Buck Institute's research originally, although we are following up on it significantly, but dietary restriction. We have known about the impact of dietary restriction on aging for decades. And what dietary restriction does is, in fact, slow aging, decrease mortality so that the subjects live longer and they live healthier. So there is abundant evidence that both lifespan and health span is extended by dietary restriction. That's true in mice, it's true in flies, it's true in yeast, it's true in worms. So dietary restriction is an important modulator of aging. Again, not at the Institute, but elsewhere, this has also been proven true in monkeys, that monkeys who are calorically restricted live longer, they live healthier, they look healthier, they act healthier, they're furrier, they're more lively, they're more interested in life. They may be a little grumpier by the dietary restriction. That's a possibility, but certainly by the caloric restriction, and this isn't starving them, of course. They wouldn't be healthier if they were starving. This is simply not allowing them to eat everything that they would like to eat. And it, in species after species after species, it has been shown to have an impact on aging. Now, by the way, don't worry about the next slide here. I'm not going to ask anybody here to calorically restrict, because it's likely that caloric restriction simply will not work in humans, that we are, because we are allowed to make our own food choices, that unless we are hugely motivated to do this, perhaps pathologically motivated to do this, caloric restriction does not seem to be a good opportunity for modulating human aging. There are people who try it. Calorierestriction.org suggests diets for people who are interested in it, but the kinds of diets that are suggested for human caloric restriction are not the kinds of diets that most of us are going to adhere to on a long-term basis. So we now know that dietary restriction affects aging. It slows aging. It slows chronic disease. What can we take from that? Well, if it's not going to work in humans, then we need to find out why dietary restriction works. We need to understand the basic biology, what's happening in dietary restriction. And there is a pathway called TOR. It's called target of rapamycin, and I'll get to that in a minute. But it appears that dietary restriction works by the same molecular pathway that rapamycin works, the target of rapamycin. This pathway was originally popularized with red wine, resveratrol, but we would have to drink much too much red wine to actually have an impact on health by trying to use that pathway. So now we need to understand why dietary restriction works, because what is this molecular pathway and how can we impact it without caloric restriction? How can we impact it with something that is really practical for human beings? The target of rapamycin molecular pathway seems extremely promising. Ironically, rapamycin was first discovered on Easter Island, but it has become the holy grail of aging research to really understand why rapamycin works. Rapamycin, by the way, is an approved drug for use in humans, but none of you should go out and try to get it. It is, right now, it's used for to prevent organ rejection, for example, after transplants. But we know that rapamycin as well slows aging. And we believe that rapamycin affects many of these chronic conditions. We believe that rapamycin itself can have an impact on neurodegeneration, on cancer, on stroke, on diabetes, and on heart disease. And this, by the way, this is from the basic biology of aging. Nobody set out to study heart disease and discovered rapamycin. This comes from understanding the molecular pathway by which something we know to slow aging, dietary restriction, works. That's the basic biology of aging, and the progress in it is amazing. So rapamycin, when you compare the efficacy of rapamycin and resveratrol, both of them increase lifespan in yeast, worms, and flies. Rapamycin increases lifespan in mice as well. Not just lifespan, by the way, but health span. You can start giving rapamycin to a mouse at the mouse equivalent of 65 years of age, and those mice start looking young. They start running around their cages. You put a novel object in their cage, and they run right over to check it out. The 65-year-old mouse is sitting there saying, whatever. But the ones with rapamycin, the ones who receive rapamycin will check it out just like a young pup will. It's really a wonder to see. Plus, they look better. We know rapamycin has an impact on obesity, neurodegeneration, and cancer in mice. Resveratrol doesn't. We know that rapamycin can have an efficacy in humans. We don't know that about resveratrol. The one drawback of rapamycin is it's not found in red wine. Not going to be as popular as resveratrol as a popular drug. But let me get back to the concept of what can we learn? How can we impact aging just by understanding the basic biology of aging? And this is a study that was just published last October by Dr. Victoria Luniak, one of our principal investigators, originally a Russian national. And she discovered that she can turn back the clock in adult human stem cells. So all of us have in our own bodies adult stem cells. If you injure your skin, your adult stem cells rush to the injured site to try to do the repair. The same is happening in the brain. If you have a stroke, it appears that the stem cells are trying to get to the site of injury, and I'll talk about that a little later. They're trying to get to the site of the stroke, and we believe it appears that's their function, to repair damage. Dr. Victoria Luniak, but the problem is adult stem cells, like all of our cells, undergo senescence. So they become much less effective. They get tired and slow as they age, and they become much less effective in cellular repair. So that's what we need to do. We need to reinvigorate those adult stem cells, and only in a petri dish so far. But Dr. Luniak discovered that the clock on adult stem cells can, in fact, be turned back, that you can take adult stem cells and cause them to act like young embryonic stem cells. Very, very promising. And again, a discovery from the basic biology of aging. Now, we don't just stop there. At the Buck Institute, we do an enormous amount of collaborative research, as I had mentioned, between the people who study basic biology and the people who study age-related disease. And we're very, very proud of some of the discoveries that are coming out of our lab. We have a vigorous program in age-related disease, spanning the neurodegenerative disorders, Alzheimer's, Huntington's, Parkinson's disease, stroke recovery, oxidative stress, exercise, the impact of exercise, the impact of nutrition, cancer, again, from the clinical practitioners, such as Dr. Benz, to the basic biologist, such as Dr. Campisi, we're beginning to understand, or we're trying to understand, the effect of aging on cancer. Dr. Greenberg, for example, studies stroke recovery. And the fascinating part about this is that we can take our discoveries from the basic biology, our discoveries about rapamycin and the TOR pathway, and allow those researchers to collaborate with the people who are working on disease, such as Dr. Kennedy works on not only the TOR pathway, but cardiovascular disease. Dr. Campisi works on cancer, but again, trying to understand the impact of rapamycin and TOR on cancer. I should have mentioned when Dr. Lunyak discovered her discovery, she uses adipose stem cells. Now, those I would like to see harvested in a great deal more, with a great deal more vigor, because, of course, those are the stem cells in your fat. And we can harvest fat from adults, cause those stem cells, although they are adult fat stem cells, we can cause them to become pluripotent stem cells, and then change those stem cells into neuronal stem cells, brain adult stem cells. So it's quite amazing, the process that's available. One of the things that I think is so exciting right now is our stroke recovery. Dr. Justin Hill works in Dr. Greenberg's lab, and Dr. Hill for years has been passionate about stroke recovery. He himself is an MD, as is Dr. Greenberg, and both are hugely frustrated by the fact that if you do not get to a stroke recovery center within 14 hours of your stroke, the best medical science can do for you in preventing damage is an aspirin. Shows the importance of getting to a treatment center immediately after a stroke. There, you simply cannot delay. But there's so many people in rural America, for example, and throughout the world, who are not going to get to a treatment center for stroke within 14 hours of the stroke. So then what do we do for them beyond an aspirin? Well, Dr. Hill discovered that one of the huge problems is the adult endogenous stem cells in our brain, the adult stem cells in your brain, are rushing to the stroke site. They light up. You can see them. Of course, we do this in mice and not human beings. But you can see the stem cells lighting up as they try to get to the stroke injury site, but they can't get there because the stroke has caused scar tissue. It's a protective mechanism, of course. I mean, just as your skin creates scar tissue to heal the scar and to protect it from further injury, so does your brain after a stroke. And apparently so does the spinal cord. So the adult stem cells are trying to get there. They can't because they simply cannot cross the scar tissue. And Dr. Hill has now published a method of eroding that scar tissue so that the stem cells can, in fact, get to the site of injury. Dr. Greenberg's lab has been doing stroke recovery research for many years. A publication in 2010 noted that there are mood drugs that affect stroke recovery. Now, think about that. It's such a problem with American research because here are mood drugs that are generic, right? Who's going to take them to the next step? And I'll get back to that a little later, that when you have a generic drug that's already out there and is used for a neuronal problem to start with, there's such little incentive in so many cases to take it to the next step and repurpose it. We study all aspects of aging, or at least we try, with our 20 laboratories. Dr. Simon Melov has recently reported that massage reduces inflammation. I mean, it feels good, right? Probably increases your mood, but it, in fact, reduces inflammation. That massage is good for you. Dr. Lisa Ellerbe works on Huntington's disease. It's a very tragic neurodegenerative disease, which is age-associated, and is trying to find the targets for drugs. And she, again, this is her life career, and she's on to it. Regenerative medicine, again, I've spoken about our stem cell research, but it is it's possibly the future of many institutes working on research, because we, again, in our bodies, we have adult stem cells, and they're there for the purpose of repair. So this is going to be, we think, a huge portion of future research. Dr. Pankaj Kapai, he does dietary restriction research to understand the basic biology of aging, but he also does research with flies to understand eating and the impact of food choices, dietary manipulation, as opposed to dietary restriction, on aging. And again, he finds that even flies have enough sense to manipulate their diet to their condition in life. A pregnant fly is not eating the same thing as an aging fly. But this is the problem in all research across the spectrum, and there, it's becoming a more and more exacerbated problem. The National Institutes of Health allows research institutes to have universities and research institutes to keep, in general, the intellectual property. And the reason for that was not true but prior to the adoption of the Bayh-Dole Act in the early 80s. It used to be that the National Institutes of Health kept all intellectual property discovered with federal dollars, which seems to make a lot of sense, right? You paid for it, you ought to keep it. The problem is drugs were not getting to the market, because the federal government is not good at drug development. It was holding all the intellectual property. It wasn't getting it to market. Congress came in and said, no, we're going to allow research institutes and universities to hold the intellectual property so that those drugs can get to market. But how? We look maybe at tens of thousands of drugs. Say we have a target. We know which molecule we're trying to target. We know which gene is the bad actor. We can test tens of thousands of compounds now. The advancement in technology is allowing for very, very rapid advances in discovery. But tens of thousands of compounds may yield 250 compounds that then have to be tested. And this is where the process falls down in the testing, because the concept, you can find many, many discoveries in the lab, but for every 250 drugs America finds that will work in a mouse, for example, one will get to FDA approval and be found efficacious and safe in human beings. That means 250 drugs have to be tested in order for one to be found safe, and the cost of this process can be $1 billion. So who has the $1 billion? Pharmaceutical companies have to obviously choose which drugs they're going to take into clinical trials very, very carefully. Universities and private institutes, of course, do not have that sort of funding to take drugs on a regular basis into trial. So it's only big pharma. The National Institutes of Health are trying to do something about that. They are trying to create methodologies by which we can test drugs earlier and cheaper. But we have a long way to go. So there's going to be a bottleneck. There already is a bottleneck right now between the clinic, between the research laboratory, the research bench, and the clinic. The only way, again, because of the valley of death, because of the expense of taking a drug to market, it is essential to create partnerships with pharmaceutical companies. And the Buck Institute is extremely fortunate to have BioMarin in Marin County, which looks at a lot of orphan and neglected disorders and diseases. We have made we have entered into a collaboration with BioMarin to test our Alzheimer's drug, and we are very, very excited about this. We are about to take this is one possibility. The BioMarin transaction is for familial Alzheimer's, and Dr. Bredesen's lab is looking at that. But beyond that, beyond familial Alzheimer's is the more common form of Alzheimer's, which affect so many people in our population. In fact, it's now thought that if you reach the age of 85, you have a 50% chance of acquiring Alzheimer's. And Dr. Bredesen is so excited about this discovery. We're about to take it for our first clinical trial in Australia with the help of the Bechtel Foundation and the Rosenberg Foundation. The theory of Dr. Bredesen's theory of Alzheimer's is at odds to Big Pharma's, but Big Pharma has had four clinical trials on Alzheimer's crash and burn in the last 2 years. Each of them seemed promising at first because the amyloid beta tangles in the brain seem to be decreasing, and yet there was no result in memory. That we seem to have a situation in which the symptoms were getting better, but the memory was not. And what's different about Dr. Bredesen's Alzheimer's intervention is that we have tested it in mice. These are mice bred for Alzheimer's disease. Every one of them will get Alzheimer's disease without an intervention. And they're taught in youth, they're taught a maze. So you can test their memory. You can continue to test their memory during their lives. The control group all lose their memory. They all forget the maze. Dr. Bredesen's group that is subject to the intervention all remember the maze throughout their lives. And yet when they, on autopsy, they show the same plaques and tangles. So we are very, very excited about the possibility that this theory of Alzheimer's, so different from Big Pharma's theory of Alzheimer's, may prove to be efficacious. And we hope to know soon out of our Alzheimer's trial in Australia. So for now, of course, diet and exercise, those are the best interventions for all of us for aging. But what we also know is that there is a huge genetic component to healthy aging. So the best advice for all of us is to choose your parents carefully, and it's probably too late. This is a family. There is a family that was featured on the cover of PLOS a year ago or so, in which the family members ranged from 92 to 95 to 98 to 104. Obviously, very, very good genes. And the cover of PLOS showed them in the looks like the early 1900s, and the picture replicated again at their current age, and all of them look healthy and vital. But this is the interesting thing about those centenarians. They're different from you and me. The people with those centenarian genes tend to be more overweight. This is the national, the NHANES 1 is a national health study on diet and exercise, on health behaviors. And a study was done, not at the Buck, but at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, on centenarians, comparing them to the average, to America's average from the NHANES 1. And what we see is centenarians are more overweight than the average American. They smoke more, like double. It's just amazing. And they don't exercise, although, of course, that might be their age that's resulting in that. You know, out of this study has come the theory that if you smoke a cigar every year for 70 years, you're likely to live to 100. But so the genetic aspect of aging is very intriguing, but very different from so many of the other conditions we study. On the other hand, we need to know what those genes are and why they're so efficacious. The oldest person on that we have a recorded date for died at 122, and many people think that that is the outer limit of human aging. You know, so many people, when we talk about the Buck Institute for Research on Aging, oh, and I should mention that this lady who died at 122 didn't quit smoking cigars until she was 100. And in fact, rode a bicycle until she was 100. You know, people ask us all the time at the Buck Institute for Research on Aging, why are you trying to extend lifespan? And we're not. We are not trying to extend lifespan. The extension of lifespan, the moderate extension of lifespan, may be an outcome of our research. But what is so much more important to us is the extension of health span. You know, people used to talk, the poem about the one horse shay, that all of a sudden it lives its useful life and it all crashes at once. And that is the model for healthy aging, to be able to live healthy and vigorous to the maximum, your maximum practical lifespan, and then to die. But to die, essentially, to die healthy, as ironic as that sounds, that's what we're working on, the extension of health span. And that concludes my remarks.
We'd like to remind our listening audience this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Mary McEachran speaking on the work of the Buck Center. We have time now for questions and answers, and I'm sure there are a lot of questions. So we'll pass the mic around so your question can be heard.
Number one, the location seems to be kind of out of the way. I wonder how you chose that location. And number two, do you, Pete, treat patients directly, or is everything kind of Ivory Tower?
Ivory Tower has nothing to do with who we are. We do not treat patients directly only because our Alzheimer's intervention that we're about to test in Australia is our first clinical intervention. We opened our doors in 1999, and this process is slow. I was talking about the drug discovery process earlier. The only reason we're able to go so quickly, and it doesn't seem so quick to all of you perhaps, but in the development of drugs, it's lightning speed. The intervention we're about to try in Australia is, in fact, approved in Australia for human use. But the process, I was talking about the cost of the process, $1 billion, the time is a minimum of 10 years to get an intervention from the bench to the clinic. The FDA, of course, is vigilant about our health and safety, but the process is sort of terrifying in terms of the length and the cost of it. So we're very, very pleased to be going to getting to into clinical trials in one of our base studies, Alzheimer's, this quickly. In terms of the location, I think that's so funny. It's a great question. And it took me a year and a half to find this location, and this is why. Our endowment comes from the Leonard and Burl Buck Foundation. Expenditures of the Leonard and Burl Buck Foundation are limited to Marin County, which means that the institute needs to be located in Marin County. UCSF was very, very helpful in getting us up and running, and their theory is you had to be located as close to UCSF as you could get. So when I started looking for the property on which to locate the institute, I started right across the Golden Gate Bridge, worked my way up north, and I would call the architect and say, this is a great property. Come see this property. And he'd come out and shake his head and say, no, Mary, forget it. Too small, too earthquake prone. Too many restrictions, so I kept working my way north until we got to Novato. Now, it turns out our 410-acre campus in Novato is probably ideally suited. It may not have been in 1989 when we purchased the property, but right now it is. We collaborate with researchers from throughout the world. The internet has made, and email and communications in this century has made international collaboration on research the norm, not the exception. So it's not just true that our researchers within the Institute collaborate, but we collaborate with researchers from UCSF, from Stanford, from Asia. From our CEO has a laboratory in China. We collaborate throughout the world. We do it easily and readily, and the location is no longer a detrimental factor. On the other hand, it's a great appeal to recruitment. This is God's country. It's gorgeous there.
Thank you. I have several questions. I was always asking myself, why is men's life expectancy always below the women's? Because they are very busy. Women work, I think, more because they have household children and their job. Why?
Well, that's a great question. It's probably genetically determined.
Always and everywhere.
It is. It is. Because it's such a common pattern just throughout societies and throughout the world. So it is probably genetically determined. It probably has to do with reproduction and care of the young. So that the ability to live longer was a protective factor, but who knows? Dr. Campisi is actually studying that, and I would invite you to come up to go on our website, look at our upcoming lectures, and when you see Dr. Campisi coming up, that has been a specific study of hers. Lots of people for so long felt it was stress-related, that somehow men experienced more stress in their lives. Some evidence for that is coming from the fact that there is now a narrowing of the life expectancies between men and women, that the trajectories are different, and that men's life expectancy is increasing on a faster trajectory than women's. So it may be stress-related, but right now we don't know.
Women usually have more stress with family, with household, with children, and job.
I think so, too. The men in the audience might disagree.
Another question. You said aspirin when you have stroke. What if you already take aspirin since many, many, many years and then you have a stroke? What kind of aspirin do you take then?
Oh, no, you should not rely on aspirin for stroke.
No, but the first.
I just meant that medical science is frustrated. It's futile to try to administer other drugs. Nothing else has proven to work. And aspirin doesn't either. All aspirin's going to do is make you feel better about your situation. But do not rely on aspirin after a stroke.
And what are mood drugs?
Oh, antidepressants. I'm sorry. Antidepressants. So antidepressants which have already been approved for human use.
Oh.
Actually, that's been that's been tested too. It's a very good theory, and that has been tested. But antidepressants, approved antidepressants, seem to be more efficacious in stroke recovery than cannabis.
Thank you.
Mary, it's about the FDA process. It seems that in Europe, things are in use long before they're in use here. Is their process different, or do they not have a process, or why is it?
Historically, that has been true. Most drugs that come to market right now are tested abroad first. Now, we're testing our Alzheimer's drug in Australia because it's approved in Australia and it's not approved for human use in America. But, in fact, Big Pharma does start its phase one trials abroad because there's so much less paperwork and bureaucracy. Eventually, however, of course, it has to come back to America. The FDA is great at protecting safety. That is their mission, is to protect safety. And the rest of the world has taken, until about now, has taken the attitude that maybe we need to actually, you know, get drugs to market to cure cancer and address some of these chronic conditions. What we're seeing, however, now is that the rest of the world is beginning to follow the FDA. So it's not going to get easier to bring drugs to market, very likely. It's going to get harder because the rest of the world is beginning to mimic the FDA requirements or else require FDA approval. China, for example, has previously been an an easier path to drug discovery, but China is beginning to emulate FDA requirements. And again, we're the best in the world for protecting safety, human safety, and it's a balancing act. Do we really want, you know, the approval, FDA approval of thalidomide, for example, set back drug approval for decades because of the concern over safety? But do we really want another thalidomide on the market? So that is the balancing act. And what the FDA is now just doing is allowing some drugs to come into market for truly fatal conditions earlier, very late-stage cancers. They're allowing those to be tested a little bit earlier with a little less trials.
This is a bit related to getting drugs on the market, but I had a hip transplant, and those were put on the market too soon. They weren't tested, and my understanding is that in Europe, they tracked it much sooner because they have registries. And is that a part of the FDA? Is that better in Europe? And how does that work along with this?
Actually, you know, I must say I'm not an expert on drug development, and so I do not know that aspect of whether how devices compare, the regulation of devices compare in Europe and in America.
And it is also that the government tracks.
Yes, of course, of course. You know, another aspect, another concern with the FDA is that the FDA allows us to test interventions for disease, but not for prevention. So you cannot do an FDA-approved trial to prevent Alzheimer's. Unless somebody is already showing symptoms of Alzheimer's, you're not allowed to do an FDA-approved trial to test a prevention in Alzheimer's. And what that is, of course, doing right now, it's forcing us, which is a good thing, it's forcing us to look for biomarkers of disease earlier and earlier. And a perfect example of that is heart disease. A biomarker of heart disease came to be cholesterol. Once you knew that cholesterol was related to heart disease, the FDA allowed drugs to be tested to reduce cholesterol levels. And that's what we need to do with all of these chronic diseases. We need to find biomarkers earlier and earlier and earlier of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and stroke susceptibility so that we can, in fact, do drug trials on preventions.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you very much. We want to thank our speaker, Mary McEachern, from the Buck Center tonight. Thank you very much, Mary. Before we go, I have one question for the audience. If we have the opportunity to have scientists from the Buck Center come here and address the grown-ups forum, would you be interested in coming back to hear that? Uh-huh. Good. I'd like to pursue that, Mary. Thank you very much. Or a field trip. It has been done. Let's try it again. All right. Well, watch the website. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned. Thank you.